This is Shush with the Apache Nation. You are listening to Light on Conspiracies.
Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
I'm here with my wonderful new friend Charlotte Thompson Easterbit, who I consider one of modern times' most important whistleblowers, since she has exposed the big time what the education system in the Western world is actually all about. But she has had to pay a high price, and last hour she told us about how her son had been shot and so on. I would very much like if we can please go into a little more detail about that, and also how we can support you in getting the files released around this case so that we can get the truth out there.
That's very good. I'll tell you, Oli, people should go to rense.com, R-E-N-S-E.com, or they can just type in to the search engine, United States and Maine Constitution dead in Maine. And there's a very important article there that they can read that gives you a lot about the case. I want to point out that evidence was not tested. It wasn't allowed. There are all sorts of things. It's just one point there. And the fact that the eyewitness and other witnesses were not called in, and it was a complete, let's just call it a total cover-up. And that is why the files, finally, there was a dismissal that we didn't like at all, which managed to let the suspect off the hook. He's running around loose with a gun. He was never arrested that night. The story is pretty much on the internet, and those people who email me, I can get anything they want. I can get to them anything they want. Now, the address here, what you would do, you would write to the Chief Justice, Cumberland County Superior Court, 205 Newberry Street, Portland, Maine, 04101. And it's regarding the state of Maine versus Samuel Easterbit versus Fred Dodge, state of Maine. And then this comes under State of Maine Supreme Judicial Court Administrative Order. And you just say, Your Honor, I'm a citizen or whatever, or a member of the press who has knowledge of the cases above outlined. And then it says that we have this thing that people can use, but they don't really have to have it. We say, please find enclosed motion for release of impounded files. Because of the public interest and First Amendment considerations, I request action at the court's earliest opportunity. And that's really all you have to say. Yours truly, please respond. This is a very important case here, of course, in the United States, but I think for those listeners from other countries, for them to know that we who espouse, as I was talking about the U.S. Constitution before, the importance of it for all countries. Remember, I talked about the Egyptian press attaché. This kind of information should be made available internationally. I'm sure it's happening everywhere. We're not the only ones. I'm afraid that similar things are happening in the United States, but we don't hear about them because nobody heard about this one. It's been a total press lockdown in the United States on this information that I'm giving you right now.
Okay, so I urge everyone who listens to this to write into the Superior Court and ask for the release of these documents so that we can get the truth out there.
I think it's important because we're looking at a global system, right? And I believe that the United States is involved. I know they are, since the exchanges with the Soviet Union and China, et cetera, these exchanges call for changes in our law. And I believe that our Constitution is being rewritten, and I fear that this case may be one of many examples of what they're looking for in the future for the world Constitution. The fact that it's been so boycotted, I can't believe we're so unpopular that they would bother to go to so much trouble unless they had a good reason. This case is important, and I don't want this happening in all the other countries that have similar exchange agreements with the Soviet Union and China and other countries. I'm not sure. I followed those two. So that's all I can say. Jeff Rentz has done most of the coverage on this. And if you go to his website, you'll see on the left-hand column, a lot of the columnists there. And under my name, you'll find all the articles I've written. But I noted for some reason, Jeff doesn't have that. It was up for a long time. The Maine, U.S. and Maine Constitution dead in Maine. That's very important. It has a very frightening, upsetting photograph there that we got in Discovery materials of my son's bloody jeans. The first incident, which took place about 8 months prior to the latest one, which really left my son quite disabled, the first one was interesting. The police tried to, and it's on an audio tape that the district attorney's office, by mistake, included in discovery materials that were given to Sam in the first incident. It was a misdemeanor, a cooked-up misdemeanor. And my son managed without a lawyer to get that dismissed. But in the process, the district attorney gave him this audio cassette, and you can click on it. That article I just said, U.S. and Maine Constitution dead in Maine. There's a little click, a little button to push underneath the bloody jeans picture. And you can hear the policeman saying he fully intended to pop Sam in the head. That was my plan. And then there's also a comment of, it's not federal anymore. That was interesting. It's not federal anymore. Well, we didn't know that it was federal at any time. What does that mean? And so my son got a hold of it. And they don't know what to do because we're letting that out all over the world, this audio where the police are planning to kill him. That's the first incident. And then when he managed to get it dismissed, 2 months later or what, sort of, Memorial Day, that's really a great day to do it to a U.S. Marine active duty combat in Gulf War I, right? They try to take him down again. But we don't know who they, in quotes, is. I want to point that out. We'd like to know, and we feel that the impounded files probably have quite a lot of information, or why would they have impounded them?
So do you see this case as connected to your research and the way you've exposed these?
Oh, definitely. I definitely see tremendous connections, yes. And of course, I'm, you know, elderly, so I think they kept figuring, and of course, you know, my son put the membership of the order up on the website, the order, you know what I mean? Because we had the only copies.
Yep.
We decided to do that finally, and it's interesting. It was shortly after we put just type in skull into my son's website, americandeception.com, and the catalogs of the complete membership of the order at Yale from 1832 to 1984 when my father received these membership lists is there. With little brief backgrounds, not too brief, tells you everything about the members of the order at Yale. We had the only copy. It's sort of interesting story I'll tell you on this one, because my dad was dying and I was taking care of him in New Jersey. And one day the postman came and he brought me this package for Dad. And it had these three black books in it. They're called catalogs, right? And they had the names of all the members of the order at Yale from 1832 to 1984 with an abstract of what they'd all done. It's absolutely fascinating, fascinating. And so at that time, remember we talked about how dumb I was? Yeah, I was pretty dumb. At that time, it didn't mean that much to me, but I took it into Dad. He was in bed and I said, this is for you, Dad. I was taking care of all his mail, paying all the bills. And he looked at it and he said, oh, they never did that before, which he meant they'd never published the names, right? So the same day, which is really weird, I get a call from Anthony Sutton, you know, who's written the great books on the order at Yale and on the banks, you know, Wall Street and the Soviet Union and Wall Street and Hitler and everything. So I had talked to Sutton in the past and we knew each other pretty well. And he asked me, he said, Charlotte, I've been doing this research. You know, he's English, Anthony Sutton, originally. and he worked for the Hoover Institute, and he wrote all these books, and he, you know, on USA to the Soviet Union and everything. And so he's considered quite a scholar. But he says to me, I don't understand. He said, I can't put my finger on exactly where this is coming from, what I've been studying for, I don't know how many years, what he'd been studying, right? And he said, do you know anything about the order at Yale? I said, well, yes, it's interesting that you should ask me that today, because I just received these three black books. And he said, you what? And he said, I know it's a family issue, and I really wouldn't expect you to want to lend them to me, but it sure would be great if you would. And I said, well, you know, okay. And I sent them to him, and he promised he'd get them back right away. Well, he called me back a couple of days later, and he said, oh, I had them copied, and I put them on the dining room table, and I looked at the names, and everything became clear to me. He said, I now know. I have the answer. So he returned them to me. And, you know, he died shortly. Well, I don't know how long after, but he did pass away. And he did say to me that he felt the most important one of all of them, the books he'd written, was How the Order Controls Education. And that book is free. That's at my son's website, americadeception.com. Sutton's book, How the Order Controls Education.
So he died suddenly or shortly after having received these books?
I don't know exactly when, 2 years, 3 years later, I was in touch with him and a very lovely lady that he knew, and she didn't understand exactly what had happened. She said she felt that it was most unusual because he was in very good health. He was living out in Reno, Nevada at the time. He did tell me that he would have all these visits from alphabet soup government officials. You know, from time to time, they come to check on him. How are you doing, Mr. Sutton? Anyway, he was a wonderful patriot, and we miss him, but he left us with a treasure trove of books, not just the ones I've mentioned. I was very happy that I had turned that over to him. And then I have to say at the end, for my dad's sake, shortly before my father passed away, I remember he was in bed. He had his Welsh Terrier on the bed with him. We were big dog people. And he looked at me. He threw the paper, the New York Times, on the floor. And he said, Char, if I had longer to live, I'd help you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was he aware that you lent out the books to Anthony Sutton?
No. No, because he died. He died before Sutton even ever mentioned it. No, I did not tell my father what I'd done.
Oh, I don't think he would have appreciated. Maybe now.
I think now. I remember at one time when I started writing, when I got involved in education at the local level, and I was writing a lot of articles, everything was being published. I can't get anything published anymore. Ever since the Heritage Foundation, which is very important in this whole mess, from 1980 on, the Heritage Foundation turned left. It's doing the dirty work for the Carnegie Corporation now, and everybody thinks it's a conservative organization. So Heritage, when it found out, first of all, when we went after the U.S.-Soviet education agreements, because Heritage supported that, those agreements, the exchanges, and even set up an office in Moscow, if you can believe it. And I was making a lot of noise about that. That's a little flyer I mentioned, Soviets in the Classroom, America's Latest Education Fad. That's also free on the internet. But I was making a lot of noise exposing Heritage, exposing all the different entities involved in those agreements, especially the agreement that Carnegie signed with the Soviet Academy of Science. Oof, that's a lot of the brainwashing stuff on the computer, terribly complicated. My little brain is not able to comprehend how this stuff works on the computer, but it does. Almost makes Skinner look innocent. It's moved on, right? But anyway, Dad, when I started writing about public education, he said to me, Char, you're really a good writer, but I don't think I like what you're writing about. And I, this is when I was still sort of stupid, uninformed. And I thought, I wonder why he doesn't like what I'm writing about.
I wonder why.
Well, if you get into the order and their role in education, you will find out why. I mean, the order, Harold Howe especially, Harold Howe was one of the first commissioners of education in the U.S. Office of Ed in the 60s. I was reading an old article in the National Educator, a wonderful little journal out of California that was must have been in the 60s. And they had all this information about Harold Howe and the integration decision, which Carnegie had actually paid Gunnar Myrdal, a Swede, to do some initial work on that. And that decision, although I certainly in favor of giving the blacks every right that they don't have or never had, right? They used that decision to put in not just the integration, which with which I would be in support, right? But by doing so, they put the busing in. And so these little black children had sometimes to be bused, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day on the bus. And this busing was all part of the regional government, which is communism, right? Agenda to break down the borders, you know, between the counties and the cities and all, because the buses would go across the borders. It's another story. It's very interesting. And the fact that Carnegie did fund Gunnar Myrdal, the Swedish professor who was one to sign the Humanist Manifesto, they funded him to do original work on it. But I don't know that he did that much because he wasn't an expert on education that much. But the people involved were Margaret Mead and Boas and a lot of these anthropologists. And I look at the integration decision and I say to myself, good grief. You know, you look at the condition of the black people in our country now, and they're far worse off, certainly as far as education, because they were used, as I said earlier, they were used for the experiments to put in the Soviet system. And I have the original Soviet papers, Soviet education papers that we managed to get our hands on. It was rather a miracle the way it happened. The farmer in Ohio was looking for something to do with seeds in the state capital. And there was this paper on this table and he picked it up. And it was the record of the visit of American educators to the Soviet Union in 1959, right after Eisenhower signed the first agreement with the Soviet Union. And it was an interesting report because they pointed out that they did go over, and they pointed out that this was not the American system. And they tell you exactly what it is, you know, Darwin, no grades, on and on and on, school to work, et cetera. It's an original document. It is at AmericanDeception.com, that document. And they actually were not that pleased with what they saw. I don't think those educators at that time wanted in any way to copy the Soviet Polytech workforce training system. So anyway, I don't know how I got off on that one, but I was, so we're go back to Dad. So Dad dies, but he did say at the end,
but Charlotte, can I ask you something? If I say to you that the education, the way it is now and the way it's been formed over many, many years, is set up to totally destroy free will, free thinking, to take away all kind of personal initiatives to make a better world, to take away, to destroy families, to promote early sex, to promote drugs, to promote criminality, to lessen all kinds of knowledge that is of importance, to take away all spiritual knowledge and power. Would you say that's correct?
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what I saw in the 1970s when I came back. I saw the agenda. That's exactly what it was. I have all the documents. They're all in my book, Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. And
so can I ask you, how did you manage to get the documents out from your office?
Well, you know, everybody listening there is probably, I don't want to give a big ad for L.L. Bean, but most people know there's this great store in Maine that sells everything. It started out with nice bean boots, L.L. Bean. It's right down the road from me. And I always had these big L.L. Bean bags. So I would gradually, over a period of a week, I would go in with my LL Bean bag and I would dump the documents in it, and then I'd take them home, you know, to my apartment. I remember one day, it's quite funny, I had one of these bags full of documents, and I was going out for lunch with my Australian friend I just mentioned, Beth the Clipper, and I ran into the top change agents in the U.S. Department of Ed. I knew who they were, right? And they were going down the hall, too, to the elevator, and I had all the stuff in the bag, and the only way I could escape was to go into the men's room. So I went in the men's room with this big bag and hoping no men would come in. And then I left and they'd gone. Then I went down the elevator and I would dump these bags in my Australian friend's Cadillac that was in the parking, downstairs basement parking of the National Institute of Education. And that's how I got it all out. And the very interesting story in regard to the U.S. Department of Ed was that Reagan, who had promised to abolish it, he selected as Secretary of Education probably the number one communist Secretary of Education we'd ever had, T.H. Bell from Utah. And the first grant that went out from my office was to Utah. And it said right in there to the superintendent of schools in Salt Lake City, this T.H. Bell, that T.H. Bell said, he answered saying, you know, in regard to the money that he was getting from the feds, we will use this, they're going to do a pilot on outcomes-based education, which is Skinner, direct instruction, performance-based stuff, all of it necessary for workforce training. We will use this grant to put outcome-based education in every state in the country. I have that letter. It's in my book. And so what happened was, this very Secretary of Education, he fired the very distinguished educator, Edward Curran, who was heading up the National Institute of Education. Now, that's the big office that's attached to my office where all the research is done. My boss was very stupid sending me up there. I spent 2 weeks up there going through all their documents. But the head of it, his name was Edward Curran. He knew what was going on, too. He and I saw this stuff, and he requested Reagan to abolish his own office, which was the National Institute of Education. He wanted to get rid of his own job, right? And that letter, Reagan was out of the country at the time, I believe, and that letter was sent by one of Reagan's top people in the White House, Dick Durbin, I think, to the Secretary of Education, T.H. Bell. That this director of the National Institute of Education, very important in himself, right? He had been the headmaster for the Cathedral School of Girls in Washington, a very prominent, good guy, apolitical basically, but the right values, huh? So Bell gets the letter from Ed Curran requesting that his own office be abolished. And then Bell fires him. Fires Ed Curran because he's not on board with this new agenda that you're looking at wherever you are in Europe and everywhere else. I mean, people will see the documents in my book. A lot of the experimentation was done by American educators who went into Korea. Outcome-based ed, one of the first pilots was in Korea. You know, so we were not only spending American taxpayers' money on bad things going on in the U.S., we were spending taxpayers' money on changing other countries' education systems. So anyway, that's very, you know, that just really blew my mind. And, you know, the goal, the grants and everything that I saw going out of the National Institute of Education, so much is in my book. You know, you don't want me to go on and on about that. But the Reagan years, when I got fired, I wrote him a long letter. And I never got an answer from him. I explained everything that was going on because I was working over in the White House. The gal that originally had put me in that job when I got myself fired, she said, well, come on over here. We'll give you an office, you know, before you go home and all. And so I managed to write a letter to the president. I never got an answer. It bothered me because I knew he had it. And I tried to get an answer. I even talked with his top guy in his office, Edwin Meese, who's now very important at Heritage, has been for 30 years. Ed Meese, I found out later, was responsible for my never getting a reply. Now, I was so busy between 1985 and the year 2000, where are we now, 15, I kept thinking about this letter. Why didn't I ever get a response? Because I knew the president had it. A journalist told me he had it. And we checked with his office. The secretary said, yes, it's on his desk. He's marked it all up. So I knew that he had it. But I never got around to writing again to find out. But 2 years ago, I decided, I guess I must have had a quiet time in my life. I decided to write the Reagan Library in regard to it. And wait, guess what happened? They got back to me. And in that file, I want to mention this. People can go to Patriots or Manchurian Candidate. It's an article I wrote. And in that article, you will see a picture of Ronald Reagan's handwritten note to Edwin Meese saying he read my letter and it was quite controversial. And obviously, it's probably better not to talk to the Department of Ed about it. But maybe I should see this lady. Ladies, Charlotte. And so the letter's up there. Well, I guess Ed Meese said no. So Reagan did, for whatever reasons he had, want to meet with me. That's a good article. It's at, you can go on the internet, just type in Patriots or Manchurian Candidates. I wrote that to warn Donald Trump, basically, but I'm sure he never saw it, about appointees to your cabinet, to White House positions. Be careful. But that is a really good article, and it's easy to find. I also have a blog that has a lot of very good stuff. It's called ABCS of dumbdownblogspot.com. ABCs of dumbdown.blogspot.com. That's a great blog that gives you the history of the whole mess, starting, I would say, in 1965, certainly even earlier, and documents. And what I did there was something would happen in education, say 3 or 4 years ago, you know, with education for all and no child left behind, all this stuff. And we would take that information and then we would attach the original documentation that I had, which was either in my book or whatever, to the current news. Do you understand what I mean? So that people would understand that all of this has been carefully planned, every single thing. I can't think of a single thing. I mean, take the community-oriented policing system we were talking about. Well, they're not going to, you know, put that in directly, right, having the cops running the town, which is outlined in a very important article by Gene Gang that is also on the internet, where you have the police station right in the middle of your town, and you have it surrounded by athletic facilities, police sleeping quarters, meditation centers, all this stuff. So this plan, which is now called community-oriented policing, originally was called community education. And it goes way back, and I found it in Camden, Maine, in the 70s, because they were trying to put it into our town. And I was upset because it wasn't using elected officials. It was just using advisory councils, right? And so we went and got the original legislation that allowed the community education and these councils. And what they did was they used adult education to get it through so that, you know, the legislators wouldn't really know what they were doing. And then you read further and it says setting up unelected councils. And I saw unelected. Oops. And then we got into it. We found out about the training that was going on in Maine, sending educators out to Michigan, which was the headquarters for community ed, always going way back, and Utah, again, same place that the Secretary of Education came from. And we had Guardians of Education remain at the moment. And so we put together a big brief with all these tabs, et cetera. And we it was very well done. And we gave it to, I sent it to the Commissioner of Education in Maine, and it ended up with Governor James Longley. This is around 1978, I guess. And one night, my husband and I are sound asleep. The telephone rings. It's 1 a.m., right? The governor calls me. He said, I'm sorry to wake you up, Mrs. Iserby, at such an hour, but I cannot call you from my office. He said, I have this brief and it's absolutely frightening, shocking. Well, the governor died mysteriously, I think, about a year later. So the community education that we were fighting back then, we fought so hard, not just in Maine, it went underground. And then I think, this is my opinion, I may be wrong, I do believe they changed the label to UN Agenda 21, because that is what UN Agenda 21 is all about. That community ed thing, which has, look, I'll tell you, this Australian friend of mine I keep talking about, she went to a community education, think cops, everybody, community-oriented policing now, that's a new name. She went to a meeting in the early 70s of community educators in Washington, D.C. And when she told me this, I was blown away. She said, one of the educators in the audience looked at the guy who was running it, the facilitator, and said, what is this? And the facilitator said, it's the Chinese communist system. Okay. Now, Chinese communists, that's okay. Of course, they got their communism from Russia. So I just think that what we're looking at is very dangerous. And it's good to get this information out to people because they don't have to believe me if they don't want. You know, that's not the purpose of the interview, right? The purpose is for people to have whatever information we world people living on this planet need to understand what we see as the system going in.
Listen, Charlotte, you know, I can't help thinking about, for instance, if you have a car like Audi or something like that, every year it gets better and better and better and better. Then you look at the education system and it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. So I would suggest that anyone who doubts what you're saying, please have a look at in your country, look at the school compared to when you were young, and now see when people come up from high school almost without being able to spell correctly. There's something definitely wrong here. But Charlotte, can I ask you, do you think that you were placed on that position in the education because they just wanted to sort of like, no disrespect, but a pretty face that was just going to take a good wage and not do anything, that you were just put there? They didn't count on you being such a powerhouse. They were just putting you there to do absolutely nothing. And then you just changed the game.
Well, I don't know, because the gal that I knew, who unfortunately now is high up with the Heritage Foundation, she was a wonderful gal from out west, and I knew her well because she had helped. She got me to establish another group I had in Maine called the Maine Conservative Union, which was an affiliate of the American Conservative Union. I liked her a lot, and we were on the same wavelength politically. And she is the one who, she got into the personnel in the White House, the office that was selecting people to go work in the department. And she knew of my activism in Maine. And I felt that Becky, maybe she didn't do it because of that. I don't think I just ended up there by mistake. I think she realized they needed someone who had gone through the fire at the local level, you know, as an elected school board member. And I made a lot of noise, and we formed this group, as I said, Guardians of Education for Maine. And I always felt that she was responsible for that. I don't think it was a mistake. It might have been, which is quite funny if it was. I mean, really, what a fluke, huh? To put me, Big Mouth, into that particular office where I had access to everything from every country, everything UNESCO involved in everything. I mean, you know, UNESCO, it's interesting. I think of UNESCO. I have an old paper from 1971 out of UNESCO, and their education group that they had, a specific group that was in charge of education, out of 20 of them, 19 came from communist countries. One was from France. And I think he probably was a communist, but, you know, I couldn't say that. But we're from communist countries. So that tells you the education system was truly, it was a communist agenda to take us down. That's smart. They're smart. You take the country down through education. You break the morals. You break the values. You dumb people down. There's a very important document at americandeception.com, and all people have to do is type the name in Hignite, and I'm going to spell it for you. H for Harry, I, G for George, N for Nicholas, I, T for Tom, E for Edward. That is a test that was given to Kenny Hignite. And mind you, it's had, I think, more hits than anything else on the website, except maybe the congressional hearings, the tax-exempt hearings. I want people to know up front that people around the world absolutely piled into what I'm telling you right now to click on. It is a test given to, in 1956, to Kenny Hignite, who died last year, who was a very good plumber out in Oregon, I think. Plumber, you know, they're often the smartest, huh? And that was his future after he got out of high school. But this is a test that he took in ninth grade, I think, in 1956 in a public school in Central California. And it's, most of it is on the Constitution of the United States. He has to tell you exactly who the Supreme Court justice was, who the cabinet officials were, all the basic principles of the Constitution, etc. His handwriting's pretty bad. But I'll tell you, you know what he got? A++. Now, people would say to me, oh, well, Kenny's just smart. And I said, wait a minute now, look. That test, it's the test itself. This is what the American education system at that point in time, in the 50s, expected. They hadn't been hit by the UN curriculum at all yet, right? Expected American students in eighth grade or whatever to be capable of doing and knowing at that time. I couldn't possibly pass that test myself. People should really go there and look at that. Kenny Hignite, just type H-I-G-N-I-T-E into the search engine at americandeception.com. That's just what you're talking about, because people are just shocked when they see what was required back then by the United States public education system.
So can I ask you another thing? I know that in, I believe it was around 1910, that the Carnegie Foundation, they made a study on how to find the most effective way to change a population. And they were studying wars and also education, and also looking into what would be the cost per person to change and get rid of the free will. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think that is just hair-raising.
Well, yes, it's very important. Carnegie, I believe, in 1906, first of all, they've been at it a long time. We call it the Carnegie Department of Education, right? In 1906, they funded and created the National Governors Association. From that time on, let's just move forward a bit to where I think you are. 1934, this is a very important document also at americandeception.com. They funded the little book, Conclusions and Recommendations for the Social Studies. I have that little book. My son scanned it into American Deception. And that's incredible, because it says basically, we will use the schools to change America's capitalist economic system to a planned economy. That's just one of the quotes. The other quotes are devastating. Devastating. That book, Conclusions and Recommendations for the Social Studies. All you have to do is type conclusions into the search engine box. Then they went on I think it was in 1933, for 8 years or whatever, they had the eight-year study. The eight-year study was the first paper ever presented, drawn up in regard to focusing on what students can do, how they can perform. It was outcomes-based education being drawn up in the 1930s. This is the eight-year study, and they used they did a pilot study in different schools. And that was the first experiment with outcome-based ed. Although it's interesting, in the late 1880s or something in England, they had something called pay for performance in England, and the teachers got so mad that they dumped it. So it's not like it's something new. So then Carnegie does that. And then in 1945, you have the United Nations. And of course, Alger Hiss, Carnegie, right? And he's a communist. And you have Brock Chisholm, psychiatrist from Canada. He was in the military. And they all get together in 1945. And they decide Hiss, it was Hiss, I think, who decided to change the definition of health from, you know, just eating properly and things like that to mental health. And Chisholm himself, terrible quotes from Chisholm in the book, he actually said, we have to get rid of the conscience. And then Chisholm's recommendations at that time were just a little bit too much for any American public school teacher to even look at, huh? But then we got to 1965, about 20 years later, and the U.S. Office of Education funded the Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program, which changed the teacher from a teacher of academics to a facilitator of behavioral change. And the teachers had to go through all of this retraining, which really was what Chisholm had said, we want to make them into little psychiatrists. I think that's what he said. And the plan was just carried out, you know, Carnegie working with Chisholm, Carnegie working also, in my updated version of Back to Basics, it's very interesting. I found an old paper there about in the 40s, a psychiatrist in Delaware was contacted by the Carnegie Corporation, I think the Scottish Rite, Masons, right, in regard to developing human relations training. That's what they called it. And that ultimately ended up being the horrible Sidney Simons values clarification, all the values destroying programs that I was talking about, drug ed, sex ed, all that. That was in the 40s. And somehow his name was Colonel Bullis in Delaware. And I found these loose pieces of paper in the research that had been given to us by this extraordinary gentleman who was independently wealthy, who had been in World War II intelligence. And after World War II, he and two friends set up a research office where they collected everything that they get their hands on. Now, a lot of that stuff is at my son's website, because he gave me, you know, his whole collection research, very fascinating stuff. And in those papers, there were these three or four pages out of a book that we didn't have the title on it. In regard to Colonel Bullis being contacted by Carnegie and the Scottish Rite Masons in Delaware to put together this, what I call totally values-destroying program, which later on I saw coming out of Bethel, Maine, and into the local school where I was working, the values-destroying programs. So that was a real find. We finally found the book by Colonel Bullis. And those pages are in the updated version of Back to Basics Reform. There's a small update that deals with school choice and charters and how that's necessary for a school to work and the corporations all involved. That's the update. It's only about 19 pages, the update. The rest of Back to Basics is the same. Yeah. You know, it's very interesting because another person who funded it, it was a woman who rented our house on Long Island. We used to have to rent our house because of the Depression. And we'd rent to people who had a lot of money. And her name was one of the funders of this first values-destroying curriculum that was funded by Carnegie and the Scottish Rite Masons in Delaware. Extraordinary. I mean, why me always, right? I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I thought, this woman who funded it was sleeping in my mother's bed because they rented our house on Long Island.
Also, you keep finding the Rockefellers in the background as well, I think, everywhere when I look into this. But Charlotte, isn't it correct also that in the papers and the agenda you found while working under Reagan, that the plan was also to get everybody hooked up to computers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a project I leaked, a Project Best. There were other projects, too, that dealt with that, but this was the key one, better education skills through technology. And that was the one I mentioned. I found that one page that was marked confidential, and I read it where they were saying that what we can control and manipulate at the local level. Well, that was the implementation of technology, computers in the schools, and giving the states, you know, they pay for all of it, right? The states take the money. They're going to have to do what the federal government wants. And they always take the money, not knowing that that's total control. But that was a very important project. And that is the one I leaked, that technology grant. And I leaked it to Human Events. And Human Events did a cover story on it. It's sort of funny story because I was sitting in my office. This is right before I got myself fired, of course. And my boss is behind a glass barrier, right? He's talking to the head of the project, Project Best it was called. And he's pointing at me, you know, showing, you know, the head of the project. He's saying, she did this, you know? And I thought, oops, I better get out of here. And I did. I went home. And because Human Events had written it all up, what I'd given them, right? And so I went home, and then the phone rang, and it was this lovely gal. She's a friend of mine who worked in the office with me. And she worked for the assistant secretary, and she said, Charlotte, I hope you got everything out, because you're not allowed back in. Yep. I had gotten everything out.
Well, I tell you, Charlotte, this type of information, you're the only one that has come forward with it, or you are the base of all this type of information that has leaked out. So what you've done is absolutely incredible and of such value for humanity, I think. So I really want to thank you.
Well, you know, I really feel that I was just sort of plucked out to do it because it was the last thing on earth I ever planned on doing. I like to play tennis. I like to paint. I like music. My path just seemed to, I was being moved always by something else. And, you know, I'm like a bird dog a bit. You know, I get a hold of something and I want to find out what it's about. I mean, some of us are that way. You are probably, or you wouldn't have your program. But I can't take credit for it. I can give a lot of credit to my husband, Belgian, who supported me 1,000,000%. And my children who had to put up with me, and my husband, a wonderful Belgian cook, you know, so he did all the cooking. Were we ever lucky? Because mom was always doing her little research or scouting around. And without my husband, I don't think I could ever have done the work that I've done. And my children, especially my son, the one who recently was, the attempted murder. And he's great, and everybody should really thank him for the work he did. I mean, how he ever has put all that stuff on the internet, because he had to hand scan every single document. I don't know how he did it. I mean, the 3,000-page Reese Committee report, 3,000 pages is sort of like tissue paper. You know, those congressional reports, that's a thin paper. And to put it through the copying machine and scan it and... I don't know how he did it. It's sort of a miracle that website ever was accomplished. I don't know how. And then I have to give tremendous credit to people who came before me that I knew well, the great Maureen Heaton, who wrote The Impossible Dream, which also has probably the top number of hits on Sam's website, Don Bell, great people, Joe Hindman, Bernadine Smith. I mean, the list goes, Colonel Arch Roberts. All these people I'm mentioning, you could find them on the internet. I don't have a list. Robert Morris, who was great. He was a judge from New Jersey, who was very well known in the conservative movement, who found my Soviets in the Classroom, America's Latest Education Fad, when he was given a job at America's Future. The guy had resigned and he took that job. And my article never, because there was such a boycott going on about what Reagan had done with the agreements with Gorbachev. There was such a boycott that article never really made it into the, you know, the public domain until Bob Morris, who had been was a judge in New Jersey and he'd been very active in the true conservative movement prior to Reagan. And one day I got a call from him and he said, Charlotte, I just found this in the bottom of my desk, in the drawer, the bottom drawer. What is this all about? Soviets in the Classroom? And he was interested because he had been, I think, a counsel for a committee in the 60s, maybe early 70s, in regard to communism in the American education system. So he sees this article and he says, What? He didn't even know. See, that was how the information was boycotted. What Reagan had done with Gorbachev, supported by the Heritage Foundation, Washington, D.C., which has an affiliate in every single state. So Bob Morris didn't know. So he said, may I publish it? I said, are you asking me 5 years later if you could publish this? Of course you can. Please, thank you. And we became very good friends. She's dead too. I've left out a lot of very important names, I'm sure, but these are the wonderful people that came before me that I will never, I thank God they existed. I pray that they're fine. They're certainly where they're meant to be. So we all just keep moving on. And I'm still around, which is sort of a miracle, and I'm very healthy. But I hope that, you know, the listeners will understand that as long as we're all still around, we have to keep doing it. And it is getting the word out, like you're doing. Wonderful work.
Thank you. Listen, Charlotte, I really, really want to thank you. Could you please let our listeners know how your websites and how to get in touch with you or support you in what you want to achieve?
Well, I think the best way is I have my website, deliberatedumbingdown.com. That's very good because it's the homepage is just jammed with links. You can find anything you want on the homepage for deliberatedumbingdown.com. You'll find the 7-disc set that we had at the conference with all the extraordinary researchers, some of whom I've just talked about right now, their work. That's the written submissions. Then you have all of the wonderful presentations that were made by marvelous, like Mary Thompson. She's probably one of our finest education researchers. She's about my age, but she started doing research before even I did. And her wonderful presentation is there. So you'll see. And if any of your listeners have any questions about wanting to know where the websites are or where they can get more information, I hope they will email me at dumbdown, one word, dumbdown00@yahoo.com. I mean, that's the easiest way to contact me. And I will, you know, maybe you'll have to wait a little bit, but I promise I will get back to you and I'll provide you with whatever I can or even answers to whatever questions you may have, because actually your listeners probably have a lot of stuff that I need too. You know, that I haven't, that's coming from over there. I know your website is fantastic. So it's a two-way street. I am by no means the only person who has the information. I think they probably figured I'd be dead by now. That'd be a shame because then I couldn't have had this interview with you, Olof.
No, exactly. I hope you're going to be along for a long, long ride more. Thank you ever so much, and I think I want to urge all listeners that have been touched by this interview to please spread it far and to as many as possible so that this information can get out there, make a massive change so that we can save our children and our future by taking back the power and stopping this brainwash. With that said, once again, thank you ever so much.
Well, thank you, and God bless all of you, and keep up the good work.